Chapter 11 Just Another Cell Sword. I realize there have been disagreements between us in the past, Adalorna Bastine said, riding beside Egwene as they passed through camp. Adalorna was a slim, regal woman. Her tilted eyes and dark hair bespoke her Saldaean heritage. I would not have you consider us enemies. I have not, Egwene said carefully, and do not. She did not ask what Adalorna meant by using the word us. She was green, and Egwene had suspected for a time that she was the Captain General, the name the Greens gave to the head of their Aja. That is well, Adalorna said. Some within the Aja have acted in foolishness. They have been informed of their mistakes. You will find no further resistance from those who should have loved you best, Mother. Whatever has passed, let it be buried. Let it be buried, Egwene agreed, amused. Now, she thought, after all of this, the Greens try to claim me? Well, she would use them. She'd been worried that her relationship with them was beyond repair. Choosing Sylviana as her keeper had made many determined to treat her as an enemy. Egwene had heard whispers that many thought she would have chosen the Red as her Aja, despite the fact that she not only had a warder but had married him. If I may ask, Egwene said, is there a particular incident which has brought about this bridge across our difficulties? Some are willfully ignorant of what you did during the Shanshan invasion, Mother, Adalorna said. You proved to have the spirit of a warrior, of a general. This is something the Green Aja must not ignore. Indeed, we must embrace it as an example. So it has been decided, and so those who lead the Aja have spoken. Adalorna met Egwene's eyes, then bowed her head. The implication was obvious. Adalorna was the head of the Green Aja. To speak it outright would not be appropriate, but to give Egwene this knowledge was to give a measure of trust and respect. If you had truly been raised from us, the action said, you would have known who led us, you would have known our secrets. I give them to you. There was also gratitude to the motion. Egwene had saved Adalorna's life during the Shanshan assault of the White Tower. The Ummerlin was of no Aja, and Egwene actually expressed this virtue more than any before her, for she never had belonged to an Aja. Still, this gesture was moving. She rested her hand on Adalorna's arm in thanks, then gave her leave to depart. Gawain, Sylviana, and Lyalwyn rode off to the side, where Egwene had sent them after Adalorna asked for a private word. That Shanshan. Egwene vacillated between keeping her close to watch her and sending her far, far away. Lyalwyn's information about the Shanshan had been useful. So far as she could determine, Lyalwyn had told her the exact truth. For now, Egwene kept her close, if only because she frequently thought of more questions about the Shanshan. Lyalwyn acted more like a bodyguard than a prisoner, as if Egwene would trust her safety to one of the Shanshan. She shook her head, riding among the gathered tents and campfires of the army. Most were empty, as Bryn had the men forming battle lines. He expected the Trolloc approach within the hour. Egwene found Bryn calmly organizing his maps and papers in a tent near the center of the camp. Yukiri was there, arms folded. Egwene dismounted and went in. Bryn looked up sharply. Mother, he exclaimed, causing her to freeze. She looked down. There was a hole in the floor of the tent, and she had nearly stepped into it. It was a gateway. The other side appeared to open into the air itself, looking down on the Trolloc army, which was crossing the hills. The recent week had involved many skirmishes, with Egwene's archers and riders slaughtering Trollocs who marched in force toward the hills and the border into Arafel. Egwene peered through this gateway in the floor. It was high up, well outside of bow range, but looking down through it at the Trollocs made her dizzy. "I'm not sure if this is brilliant," she said to Bryn, "or incredibly foolhardy." Bryn smiled, turning back to his maps. "Winning wars is about information, Mother. If I can see exactly what they are doing, where they are trying to envelop us and how they are bringing in reserves, I can prepare. This is better than a battle tower. I should have thought of it ages ago."
"The Shadow has dreadlords who can channel, General," Egwene said. "Peeking through this gateway could get you burned to a crisp. That's not to mention Drakkar. If a flock of them tried to fly through this..."
"Drakkar are shadow spawn," Bryn said. "I've been told that they'd die passing through the gateway."
"I guess that's true," Egwene said. "But you'd have a flock of dead Drakkar in here. Regardless, channelers can still attack through it."
"I will take that chance. The advantage offered is incredible."
"I'd still rather you use scouts to look through the gateway," Egwene said. "Not your own eyes. You are a resource, one of our most valuable. Risks are unavoidable, but please take care to minimize them."
"Yes, Mother," he said.
She inspected the weaves, then eyed Yukiri. "I volunteered, Mother," Yukiri said before Egwene could ask how a sitter ended up doing simple gateway duty. "He sent to us, asking if forming a gateway like this, horizontal instead of vertical, was possible. I thought it an interesting puzzle." She was not surprised he had sent to the Greys. There was a growing sentiment among them that, just as the Yellows specialized in healing weaves and the Greens specialized in battle weaves, the Greys should take particular interest in weaves for traveling. They seemed to consider travel part of their calling as mediators and ambassadors.
"Can you show me our own lines?" Egwene asked.
"Certainly, Mother," Yukiri said, closing the gateway. She opened another, letting Egwene look down on the battle lines of her army as they formed up in defensive positions on the hills.
This was more efficient than maps. No map could completely convey the lay of a land, the way that troops moved. Egwene felt as if she were looking at an exact replica of the landscape in miniature.
Vertigo hit her suddenly. She was standing at the edge of a drop of hundreds of feet. Her mind reeled, and she stepped back, taking a deep breath.
"You need to put a rope up around this thing," Egwene said. "Someone could step right off.
Or pitch head first while staring down." Bryn grunted.
"I sent Swan for something like that."
He hesitated.
"She didn't much like being sent, though, so she might come back with something completely useless."
"I keep wondering," Yukiri said. "Shouldn't there be a way to create a gateway like this, but make it so it can only let light through? Like a window. You could stand on it and look down without fearing that you could slip through. With the right weaves, you might be able to make it invisible from the other side."
"Stand on it?
Light! You'd have to be mad."
"Lord Bryn," Egwene said, "your battle lines seem very solid."
"Thank you, Mother."
"They're also lacking."
Bryn raised his head.
Other men might have risen to the challenge, but he did not. Perhaps it was all of that practice in dealing with Morghese.
"How so?"
"You form up the troops as usual," Egwene said. "Archers at the front and on the hills to slow the enemy advance. Heavy cavalry to charge and hit, then withdraw. Pikes to hold the line. Light cavalry to protect our flanks and keep us from being surrounded."
"The soundest battle strategies are often those that are time-tested," Bryn said. We may have a large force with all of those dragons sworn, but we're still outnumbered. We can't be more aggressive than I've been here.
Yes, you can be, Egwene said calmly. She met his eyes. This is unlike any battle you've ever fought, and your army is not like any you've ever led, General. You have a major advantage that you are not taking into account.
You mean the Aes Sedai?
Bloody right I do, she thought. Light! She'd been spending too much time around Elaine.
I did account for you, Mother, Bryn said. I had planned for the Aes Sedai to be a reserve force to aid companies in disengaging so we can rotate in fresh troops.
Pardon, Lord Bryn, Egwene said. Your plans are wise, and certainly some of the Aes Sedai should be used that way. However, the White Tower did not prepare and train for thousands of years to sit out the last battle as a reserve force. Bryn nodded, slipping a new set of documents out from underneath his pile.
I did consider other more dynamic possibilities, but I did not want to overstep my authority.
He handed her the documents. Egwene scanned them, raising an eyebrow. Then she smiled.
Matt had not remembered so many tinkers around Ebu Dar. Brilliantly colored wagons grew like vibrant mushrooms on an otherwise dun field. There were enough of them to make a bloody city. A city of tinkers? That would be like a city of Aiel. It was just wrong. Matt trotted Pips along the roadway. Of course, there was an Aiel city. Maybe there would be a tinker city someday, too. They would buy up all of the colored dye, and everyone else in the world would have to wear brown. There would be no fighting in the city, so it would be downright boring. But there also would not be a single bloody pot with a hole in the bottom for 30 leagues. Matt smiled, patting Pips. He had covered over his Ashandarai as best he could to make it look like a walking pole strapped to the side of the horse. His hat lay inside the pack he had hung from the saddlebags, along with all of his nice coats. He had ripped the lace off the one he wore. It was a shame, but he did not want to be recognized. He wore a crude bandage wrapped around the side of his head, covering his missing eye. As he approached the Dalaira gate, he fell into line behind the others awaiting permission to enter. He should look just like another wounded sellsword riding into the city, seeking refuge or perhaps work. He made certain to slump in the saddle. Keep your head down. Good advice on the battlefield and when entering a city where people knew you. He could not be Matrim Cawthon here. Matrim Cawthon had left the queen of this city tied up to be murdered. Many would suspect him of the murder. Lighty would have suspected himself. Veslin would hate him now, and there was no telling how Tuon would feel about him, now that they had had some time apart. Yes, best to keep his head down and stay quiet. He would feel the place out. If, that was, he ever reached the front of this bloody line. Who ever heard of a line to enter a city? Eventually, he reached the gate. The bored soldier there had a face like an old shovel. It was half covered in dirt and would be better off locked in a shed somewhere. He looked Matt up and down.
You have sworn the oaths, traveler? The guard asked in a lazy Shan-Chan drawl.
On the other side of the gate, a different soldier waved over the next person in line.
Yes, I have indeed, Matt said. The oaths to the great Shan-Chan Empire and the Empress herself, may she live forever. I'm just a poor traveling sellsword, once attendant to House Hawk, a noble family in Murrindy. I lost my eye to some bandits in the Tween Forest 2 years back while protecting a young child I discovered in the woods. I raised her as my own, but...
The soldier waved him on. The fellow did not look as if he had been listening. Matt considered staying put out of principle. Why would the soldiers force people to wait in such a long line and give them time to think of a cover story only not to hear it out? That could offend a man. Not Matrim Cawthon, who was always light-hearted and never offended. But someone else, surely. He rode on, containing his annoyance. Now he just needed to make his way to the right tavern. Pity Satala's place was not an option any longer. That had... Matt stiffened in the saddle, though Pips continued his leisurely pace forward. Matt had just taken a moment to look at the other guard at the gate. It was Petra, the strong man from Balan Luka's menagerie. Matt looked the other way and slumped again in his saddle, then shot another glance over his shoulder. That was Petra, all right. There was no mistaking those log arms and that tree-stump neck. Petra was not a tall man, but he was so wide an entire army could have taken shade in his shadow. What was he doing back in Ebu Dar? Why was he wearing a Shonchan uniform? Matt almost went over to talk to him, as they had always been amiable, but that Shonchan uniform made him reconsider. Well, at least his luck was with him. If he had been sent to Petra instead of the guard he had ended up talking to, he would have been recognized for sure. Matt breathed out, then climbed down to lead Pips. The city was crowded, and he did not want the horse pushing someone over. Besides, Pips was laden down enough to look like a pack horse, if the looker knew nothing of horses, and walking might make Matt less memorable. Perhaps he should have started his search for a tavern in the Rahad. Rumors were always easy to find in the Rahad, as was a game of dice. It was also the easiest place to find a knife in your gut, and that was saying something in Ebu Dar. In the Rahad, people were as likely to take out their knives and begin killing as they were to say hello in the morning. He did not go into the Rahad. The place looked different now. There were soldiers camped outside it. Generations of successive rulers in Ebu Dar had allowed the Rahad to fester unchecked, but the Shonchan were not so inclined. Matt wished them luck. The Rahad had fought off every invasion so far. Light. Rand should have just hidden there, instead of going up to fight the last battle. The Trollocs and Dark Friends would have come for him, and the Rahad would have left them all unconscious in an alley, their pockets turned inside out and their shoes sold for soup money. Matt caught a glimpse of Rand shaving, but he squashed the image. Matt shouldered his way over a crowded canal bridge, keeping a close eye on his saddlebags. But so far, not a single cut purse had tried for them. With a Shonchan patrol on every other corner, he could see why. As he passed a man yelling out the day's news, with hints that he had good gossip for a little coin, Matt found himself smiling. He was surprised at how familiar, even comfortable, this city felt. He had liked it here. Though he could vaguely remember grumbling about wanting to be away, probably just after the wall fell on him, as Matt from Cotton was not often one for grumbling, he now realized that his time in Ebu Dar had been among the best of his life. Plenty of cards and dice in the city. Tylin. Bloody ashes, but that had been a fun game. She had had the better of him time and again. Light sent him plenty of women who could do that, though not in rapid succession, and always when he knew how to find the back door. Tuon was one. Come to think of it, he would probably never need another. She was enough of a handful for any man. Matt smiled, patting Pips on the neck. The horse blew down Matt's neck in return. Strangely, this place felt more like home to him than the Two Rivers did. Yes, the Ebu Dari were prickly, but all peoples had their quirks. In fact, as Matt thought about it, he had never met a people who were not prickly about one thing or another. The Borderlanders were baffling, and so were the Aiel. That went without saying. The Kyrianen and their strange games, the Tyrans and their ridiculous hierarchies, the Shonchan and their... Shonchan-ness. That was the truth of it. Everyone outside the Two Rivers, and to a lesser extent Andor, was bloody insane. A man just had to be ready for that. He strolled along, careful to be polite, lest he find a knife in his gut. The air smelled of 100 sweetmeats, the chattering crowd a low roar in his ears. The Ebu Dari still wore their colorful outfits. Maybe that was why the tinkers had come here, drawn to the bright colors like soldiers drawn to dinner. Anyway, the Ebu Dari women wore dresses with tight-laced tops that showed plenty of bosom. Not that Matt looked. Their skirts had colorful petticoats underneath, and they pinned up the side or front to show them off. that never had made sense to him. Why put the colorful parts underneath? And if you did, why take such pains to cover them over, then go around with the outside pinned up? The men wore long vests that were equally colorful, perhaps to hide the bloodstains when they were stabbed. No point in throwing away a good vest just because the fellow wearing it was murdered for inquiring after the weather. Though, as Matt walked along, he found fewer jewels than he had expected. They never had been as common in this part of the city as in the Rahad, but some days he had hardly been able to take two steps without passing a pair of men with knives out. This day he saw not a single one. Some of the Ebudari, you could often tell them by their olive skin, were parading around in Shonchan dress. Everyone was very polite. As polite as a 6-year-old boy who had just heard that you had a fresh apple pie back in the kitchen. The city was the same, but different. The feel was off a shade or two. And it was not just that there were no sea folk ships in the harbor any longer. It was the Shonchan, obviously. They'd made rules since he'd left. What kind? Matt took Pips to a stable that seemed reputable enough. A quick glance at their stock told him that. They were caring well for the animals, and many were very fine. It was best to trust a stable with fine horses, though it cost you a little more. He left Pips, took his bundle, and used the still-wrapped Ashandarai as a walking staff. Choosing the right tavern was as tough as choosing a good wine. You wanted one that was old, but not broken down. Clean, but not too clean. A spotless tavern was one that never saw any real use. Matt could not stand the types of places where people sat around quietly and drank tea, coming there primarily to be seen. No, a good tavern was worn and used, like good boots. It was also sturdy, again like good boots. So long as the ale did not taste like good boots, you would have a winner. The best places for information were over in the Rahad, but his clothing was too nice to visit, and he did not want to run into whatever the Shonchan were doing there. He stuck his head into an inn named the Winter Blossom and immediately turned around and stalked away. Death Watch guards in uniform. He did not want to take any slight chance of running into Furik Kareed. The next inn was too well lit, and the next too dark. After about an hour of hunting, and not a duel to be seen, he began to despair of ever finding the right place. Then he heard dice tumbling in a cup. At first he jumped, thinking it was those blasted dice in his head. Fortunately, it was just ordinary dice. Blessed, wonderful dice. The sound was gone in a moment, carried on the wind through the throng of people in the streets. Hand on his coin purse, pack over his shoulder, he pushed through the crowd, muttering a few apologies. In a nearby alleyway, he saw a sign hanging from a wall. He stepped up to it, reading the words, "The Yearly Brawl," in copper on its face. It had a picture of clapping people and the sounds of dice mixed with the smells of wine and ale. Matt stepped inside. A round-faced Shonchan stood just inside the door, leaning casually against the wall, a sword on his belt. He gave Matt a distrustful stare. Well, Matt had never met a shoulder-thumper who did not give that look to every man who entered. Matt reached up to tip his hat to the man, but of course he was not wearing it. Bloody ashes. He felt naked without it sometimes.
"Jim," a woman called from beside the bar, "you aren't glaring at customers again, are you?"
"Only the ones that deserve it, Kathana," the man called back with a Shonchan slur. "I'm sure this one does."
"I'm just a humble traveler," Matt said, "looking for some dicing and some wine. Nothing more. Certainly not trouble."
"And that's why you're carrying a pole arm?" Jame asked. "Wrapped up like that?"
"Oh, stop it," the woman Kathana said.
She had crossed the common room and took Matt by the sleeve of his coat, dragging him toward the bar. She was a short thing, dark-haired and fair-skinned. She was not that much older than he was, but she had an unmistakable motherly air.
"Don't mind him. Just don't make trouble and he won't be forced to stab you, kill you, or anything in between."
She plunked Matt down on a bar stool, and started busying herself behind the bar. The common room was dim, but in a friendly way. People diced at one side, the good kind of dicing, the kind that had people laughing or clapping their friends on the back at a good-natured toss. No haunted eyes of men gambling their last coin here.
"You need food," Cathana declared. "You have the look of a man who hasn't eaten anything hearty in a week. How'd you lose that eye?" "I was a Lord's Guard in Murundi," Matt said. "Lost it in an ambush." "That's a great lie," Cathana said, slapping a plate down in front of him, full of slices of pork and gravy.
"Better than most. You said it really straight, too. I almost believe you. Jame, you want food?"
"I have to guard the door," he called back.
"Light man, you expect someone to walk off with it? Get over here."
Jame grumbled, but made his way over to the bar beside Matt, settling down on a stool. Cathana put a mug of ale down, and he took it up to his lips, staring straight ahead.
"I'm watching you," he muttered to Matt.
Matt was not certain this was the right inn for him, but he also was not certain he would be able to escape with his head unless he ate the woman's food as instructed. He took a taste. It was pretty good. She had moved over and was wagging a finger while lecturing a man at one of the tables. She seemed the type who would lecture a tree for growing in the wrong spot. This woman, Matt thought, must never be allowed to enter the same room as Nynaeve, at least not when I'm within shouting distance. Cathana came bustling back. She wore a marriage knife at her neck, though Matt did not stare for more than a few seconds on account of him being a married man. She had her skirt pinned up on the side after the fashion of Ebu Dari commoners. As she came back to the bar and readied a plate of food for Jame, Matt noticed him watching her fondly and made a guess.
"You two been married long?" Matt asked.
Jame eyed him.
"No," he finally said. "Haven't been on this side of the ocean for long."
"I suppose that would make sense," Matt said, taking a drink of the ale she set before him. It was not bad, considering how awful most things tasted these days. This was only a little awful. Cathana walked over to the dicing men and demanded they eat more food, as they were looking pale. It was a wonder this Jame fellow did not weigh as much as 2 horses. She did talk some, though, so perhaps he could wiggle the information he needed out of her.
"There don't seem to be as many jewels as there used to be," Matt said to her as she passed.
"That's because of a Shan-Chan rule," Cathana said, "from the new empress. May she live forever. She didn't forbid jewels entirely, and a bloody good thing she didn't. The Ebu Dari won't riot at something as unimportant as being conquered, but take away our jewels, then you'll see something. Anyway, jewels now have to be witnessed by an official of the government. You can't duel without answering 100 different questions and paying a fee. It's drained the whole life out of it all."
"It has saved lives," James said. "Men can still die by each other's knives if they are determined. They simply have to give themselves time to cool down and think."
"Duels aren't about thinking," Cathana said. "But I suppose it does mean that I don't have to worry about your pretty face being cut up on the street."
James snorted, resting his hand on his sword. The hilt, Matt noticed for the first time, was marked with herons, though he could not see if the blade was or not. Before Matt could ask another question, Cathana marched away and began squawking at some men who had spilled ale on their table. She did not seem the type to stand in one place for very long.
"How's the weather to the north?"
Jame asked, eyes still straight ahead.
"Dreary,"
Matt replied honestly. "As everywhere."
"Men say it's the last battle," Jame said.
"It is,"
Jame grunted.
"If it is, it would be a bad time for interfering with politics, wouldn't you think?"
"Bloody right it would be," Matt said. "People need to stop playing games and have a look at the sky."
Jame eyed him.
"That's the truth. You should listen to what you are saying."
Light, Matt thought. He must think I'm a spy of some sort.
"That's not my choice," Matt said. "Sometimes people will only listen to what they want to hear."
He took another bite of his meat, which tasted as good as could be expected. Eating a meal these days was like going to a dance where there were only ugly girls. This, however, was among the better of the bad that he had had the misfortune of eating lately.
"A wise man might just learn the truth," James said.
"You have to find the truth first," Matt said. "It's harder than most men think." From behind, Cathana snorted, bustling past.
"The truth is something men debate in bars when they're too drunk to remember their names. That means it's not in good company. I wouldn't put too much stock in it, traveler."
"The name's Mandevwin," Matt said. "I'm sure it is," Cathana said. She looked him over then. "Has anyone ever told you that you should wear a hat? It would fit the missing eye quite well."
"Is that so?" Matt said dryly. "You give fashion advice as well as force-feeding men?"
She swatted him on the back of the head with her cleaning rag.
"Eat your food."
"Look, friend," James said, turning toward him. "I know what you are and why you're here. The fake eye bandage is not fooling me. You have throwing knives tucked into your sleeves and 6 more on your belt that I can count. I've never met a man with one eye who can throw worth a dried bean. She's not as easy a target as you foreigners think. You'll never make it into the palace, let alone through her bodyguards. Go find some honest work instead."
Matt gaped at the man. He thought Matt was an assassin? Matt reached up and took off the bandage, exposing the hole where his eye had been. James stared at that.
"There are assassins," Matt said calmly, "after Tuon."
"Don't use her name like that," Cathana said, beginning to snap her cleaning rag at him again. Matt reached up beside his head without looking, catching the tip of the rag. He held James' eyes with his single one, not flinching.
"There are assassins," Matt repeated calmly, "after Tuon."
James nodded.
"Mostly foreigners who don't know the right way of things. Several have moved through the inn. Only one admitted the reason he was here. I saw that his blood fed the dusty earth of the dueling grounds."
"Then I count you a friend," Matt said, standing.
He reached into his bundle and took out his hat and put it upon his head.
"Who is behind it? Who has brought them in? Put the bounty on her head."
Nearby, Cathana inspected his hat and nodded in satisfaction. Then she hesitated and squinted at his face.
"This isn't what you think," James said. "He isn't hiring the best assassins. They're foreigners, so they aren't meant to succeed."
"I don't care how bloody likely their chances are," Matt said. "Who is hiring them?"
"He's too important for you to..."
"Who?"
Matt said softly.
"General Lunal Galgan," James said. "Head of the Shonshan armies. I can't make you out, friend. Are you an assassin, or are you here hunting assassins?"
"I'm no bloody assassin," Matt said, pulling the brim of his hat down and picking up his bundle. "I never kill a man unless he demands it. Demands it with screams and thunder so loudly, I figure it would be impolite not to agree to the request. If I stab you, friend, you'll know that it is coming, and you will know why. I promise you that."
"James," Cathana hissed. "It's him."
"What now?"
James asked as Matt brushed past, raising his covered Ashendari to his shoulder.
"The one the guards have been looking for," Cathana said.
She looked to Matt.
"Light, every soldier in Abu Dhar has been told to watch for your face. How did you make it through the city gates?"
"By luck," Matt said, then stepped out into the alleyway.
"What are you waiting for?"
Moraine asked.
Rand turned toward her. They stood in Lan's command tent in Shinar. He could smell the smoke of burning fields set aflame by Lan and Lord Agamar's troops as they withdrew from the gap. They were burning the lands they would rather defend. A desperate tactic, but a good one. It was the sort of all-in tactic that Luz Theron and his people in the Age of Legends had been hesitant to try, at least at first. It had cost them dearly then. The borderlanders showed no such timidity.
"Why are we here?"
Moraine pressed, stepping up to him. His maidens guarded the tent from the inside. Better to not let the enemy know Rand was here.
You should be at Shale Ghul right now. That is your destiny, Randall Thor. Not these lesser fights.
My friends die here.
I thought you were beyond such weaknesses.
Compassion is not a weakness.
Is it not? She said. And if, in sparing your enemy because of compassion, you allow them to kill you, what then, Randall Thor?
He had no answer.
You cannot risk yourself, Moraine said. And regardless of whether or not you agree that compassion itself can be a weakness, acting foolishly because of it certainly is.
He had often thought about the moment when he had lost Moraine. He had agonized over her death, and he still reveled in her return. At times, however, he had forgotten how insistent she could be.
I will move against the Dark One when the time is right, Rand said. But not before. He must think I am with the armies, that I am waiting to seize more ground before striking at him. We must coax his commanders to commit their forces southward, lest we be overwhelmed at Shale Ghul once I enter.
It will not matter, Moraine said. You will face him, and that will be the time of determination. All spins on that moment, Dragon Reborn. All threads in the pattern are woven around your meeting, and the turning of the wheel pulls you toward it. Do not deny that you feel it.
I feel it.
Then go.
Not yet.
She took a deep breath.
Stubborn as ever.
And a good thing, Rand said. Stubbornness is what brought me this far. Rand hesitated, then fished in his pocket. He came out with something bright and silvery. A Tarvalen mark. Here, he said, holding it out to her. I've been saving this. She pursed her lips.
It cannot be.
The same one? No.
That is long lost, I fear. I've been carrying this one around as a token, almost without realizing what I'd been doing.
She took the coin, turning it over in her fingers. She was still inspecting it when the maidens looked with alertness toward the tent flap. A second later, Lan lifted the flap and strode in, flanked by two Malkieri men. The three could have been brothers, with those grim expressions and hard faces. Rand stepped up, resting his hand on Lan's shoulder. The man did not look tired. A stone could not look tired. But he did look worn. Rand understood that feeling. Lan nodded to him, then looked at Moraine.
Have you two been arguing?
Moraine tucked the mark away, face becoming impassive. Rand didn't know what to make of the interaction between the two of them since Moraine's return. They were civil, but there was a distance between them that he had not expected.
You should listen to Moraine, Lan said, turning back to Rand. She has prepared for these days longer than you have been alive. Let her guide you.
She wants me to leave this battlefield, Rand said, and strike immediately for Shale Ghul instead of trying to fight those channelers for you so you can retake the gap.
Lan hesitated.
Then perhaps you should do as she...
No, Rand said.
Your position here is dire, old friend. I can do something, and so I will. If we can't stop those dreadlords, they'll have you retreating all the way back to Tarvalen.
I have heard what you did at Maradon, Lan said. I will not turn away a miracle here if one is determined to find us.
Maradon was a mistake, Moraine said tersely. You cannot afford to expose yourself, Rand.
I cannot afford not to, either. I won't just sit back and let people die. Not when I can protect them.
The Borderlanders do not need to be sheltered, Lan said.
No, Rand replied. But I've never known one who would refuse a sword when one was offered in a time of need.
Lan met his eyes, then nodded.
Do what you can.
Rand nodded to the two maidens, who nodded back.
Sheepherder,
Lan said. Rand raised an eyebrow.
Lan saluted him, arm across his chest, bowing his head. Rand nodded back.
There is something for you on the floor over there, Daishan.
Lan frowned, then walked to a pile of blankets. There were no tables in this tent. Lan knelt, then raised a bright, silvery crown, thin yet strong.
The crown of Malkir, he whispered. This was lost.
My smiths did what they could with old drawings, Rand said. The other is for Nynaeve. I think it will suit her.
You have ever been a king, my friend. Elaine taught me to rule, but you taught me how to stand. Thank you.
He turned to Moraine. Keep a space clear for my return. Rand seized the one power and opened a gateway. He left Lan kneeling, holding the crown, and followed his maidens out onto a black field. Burned stalks crunched beneath his boots, and smoke wreathed the air. The maidens immediately sought shelter in a small depression in the field, huddling against the blackened earth, prepared to weather the storm. Because one was certainly brewing. Trollocs milled in a large mass before Rand, prodding at the soil and at the remains of farmhouses. The River Mora rushed nearby. This was the first cultivated land south of Tarwin's Gap. Lan's forces had burned it before preparing to retreat downriver ahead of the Trolloc advance. There were tens of thousands of the beasts here, perhaps more. Rand raised his arms, forming a fist, drawing in a deep breath. In the pouch at his belt he carried a familiar object, the small fat man with the sword, the Angreal he had recently found at Dumai's Wells. He had returned there for one last look and found it buried in the mud. It had been useful at Maradon. Nobody knew he had it. That was important. But there was more to what he would do here than tricks. Trollocs shouted as the winds whipped up around Rand. This was not the result of channeling, not yet. It was Rand, being here, confronting him. Seas grew choppy when different streams of water crashed into one another. Winds grew powerful when hot air and cool mixed. And where light confronted shadow, storms grew. Rand shouted, letting his nature stir the tempest. The Dark One pressed upon the land, seeking to smother it. The pattern needed equalization. It needed balance. It needed the dragon. The winds grew more powerful, lightning breaking the air, black dust and burned stalks flipping up, twisting about in the maelstrom. Rand finally channeled as Murdral forced the Trollocs to attack him. The beasts charged against the wind, and Rand directed the lightning. It was so much easier to direct than control. With a storm already in place, he didn't need to force the lightning. He needed only to cajole it. Strikes destroyed the front groups of Trollocs, 100 bolts of lightning in succession. The pungent scent of burnt flesh swirled in the storm, joining the charred stalks of grain. Rand roared as the Trollocs kept coming. Death gates sprang up around him, gateways that zipped across the ground like water striders, sweeping Trollocs into death. Shadowspawn could not survive traveling. The storm winds rose around Rand as he struck down those Trollocs who tried to reach him. The Dark One thought to rule here. He would see this land already had a king. He would see that the fight would not. A shield tried to sever Rand from the source. He laughed, spinning, trying to pinpoint the shield's origin.
Taim, he yelled, though the storm captured his voice and overwhelmed it. I had hoped you would come.
This was the fight that Luce Theron had constantly demanded of him, a fight Rand hadn't dared begin. Not until now. Not until he had control. He summoned his strength, but then another shield struck at him, and another. Rand drew in more of the one power, tapping nearly all that he could through the fat man Angreal. Shields continued to snap at him like biting flies. None were strong enough to sever him from the source, but there were dozens of them. Rand calmed himself.
He sought peace, the peace of destruction. He was life, but he was also death. He was the manifestation of the land itself. He struck, destroying an unseen dreadlord hiding in the rubble of a burned building nearby. He summoned fire and directed it at a second, burning him to nothingness. He could not see the weaves of the women out there. He could only feel their shields. Too weak. Each shield was too weak, and yet their attacks had him worried. They had come quickly, at least 36 dreadlords, each trying to cut him off from the source. This was dangerous, that they had anticipated him. That was why they had hit land so hard with channelers, to draw Rand out. Rand fought off the attacks, but none of them were in danger of truly shielding him. A single person could not cut off someone holding as much Sayadin as he was. They should have... He saw it right before it happened. The other attacks were cover, feints. One that was coming would be created by a circle of men and women. A man would be leading. There! A shield slammed against him, but Rand had had just enough time to prepare. He channeled spirit in the tempest, weaving by instinct from Luz Theron's memories, and rebuffed the shield. He shoved it away, but could not destroy it. Light. That had to be a full circle. Rand grunted as the shield slipped closer to him. It made a vibrant pattern in the sky, motionless despite the tempest. Rand resisted it with his own surge of spirit and air, holding it back as if it were a knife hanging above his throat. He lost control of the tempest. Lightning crashed around him. The other channelers wove to enhance the storm. They didn't try to control it, for they didn't need to. It being out of control served them, as at any moment it could strike Rand. He roared again, louder this time, more determined.
I will beat you, Taim. I will finally do what I should have done months ago.
But he did not let the anger, the wildness, force him into conflict. He couldn't afford to. He had learned better than that. This was not the place. He could not fight here. If he did, he would lose. Rand pushed with a surge of strength, throwing back Taim's shield, then used the moment of respite to weave a gateway. His maidens went through immediately, and Rand, ducking his head against the wind, reluctantly followed. He leaped into Lan's tent, where Moiraine had done as he requested and kept space open for him. He closed his gateway, and the winds stilled, the noise dampened. Rand formed a fist, panting, sweat running down the sides of his face. Here, back with Lan's army, the tempest was distant, although Rand could hear it rumbling, and faint winds stirred the tent. Rand had to fight to keep from sinking to his knees. He sucked in large breaths. With difficulty, he slowed his racing heart and brought calmness to his face. He wanted to fight, not run. He could have beaten Taim. And in so doing, would have weakened himself so far that the Dark One would have taken him with ease. He forced his fist to open and wrestled control of his emotions. He looked up at Moiraine's calm, knowing face.
It was a trap, she asked.
Not so much a trap, Rand said, as a battlefield well prepared with sentinels. They know what I did at Maradon. They must have teams of dreadlords waiting to travel to wherever I'm spotted and attack me.
You have seen the error in this line of attack? She asked.
Error? No. Inevitability? Yes. He couldn't fight this war personally. Not this time. He would have to find another way to protect his people.